accession number 30416, Mr. John Taylor, Reel 7. Now, we'll continue with our, it's this raid you went, the first raid against St. Medard Angel on the 28th of April 1944. Now, after you'd got all your kit that we've just discussed, you know, together and got it on in the crew room, now what would happen then? How would you get to, where would the aircraft be? Where would your aircraft be?
There'd be dispersal points all around the perimeter of the aircraft. Dispersal if the aircraft, the air drone was attacked, minimise the losses. And a crew bus would arrive to take us out. Sometimes it was a kind of converted bus. Sometimes it was merely a truck with a tailgate down that we climbed into. Usually it would hold the two crews that went to a certain dispersal, and little WAF drivers used to get lots of whistles from the lads, and we drive out and go to the dispersal, and then we would sprawl on the ground outside our aircraft while the pilot and engineer walk round the outside checking all the aerolons were free, all the other things, running up the engines and looking at the mag drop, because he had to sign a form to say that he was willing to accept the aircraft. Jack didn't always accept the aircraft. If he thought there was the slightest thing wrong with it, the mag drop was too much or something, he would refuse to take it, and we would be assigned to another spare aircraft.
Would you have done a prior flight check, flight test?
Yes, that afternoon.
And what would, we'll drop that in, what would the flight test be?
That would just be circuits and bumps, nothing for me to do. It was purely for the...
Would you go up in it?
I'd go up in it, yes.
But you'd just fly around?
The whole crew would go up in it, but we'd just fly around, take off and land a couple of times. And then that was it. So at that stage, you know, the aircraft was okay.
So after you'd signed the form, or rather Jack had signed this form, what would happen then? Did you have any superstitions, I should have asked before?
We had a lot of superstitions.
Because some crews do, some crews don't. What were yours and your crew's superstitions?
Well, I had a picture of my girlfriend, Joan, I was going steady with at this time. In fact, I think I was engaged, but I said I wasn't going to marry her until I'd come out off ops. And her picture in the Perspex holder was hanging on the bit between the wireless ops position and mine. And all the crew, as they got in, would touch this for luck, even including the rear gunner, who would come up specially to touch it and then go back to his position.
Any other superstitions?
Not on our crew. There was a crew where the navigator always flew in a top hat and wore a white silk scarf, things like that, and they had their teddy bears and things like that, but no, that was the only thing. If we're still talking about those superstitions, on one of our trips, because our aircraft had got shot up on the night before, we were flying in a strange aircraft, and we'd just got in, and we realised that the picture of Joan wasn't in, it was still in our aircraft back at dispersal, and hastily, rear gunner shouted a message to the sergeant. Our crew sergeant, he got on his bike and pedalled round the dispersal. All the time we were going slowly round the perimeter track, and he just got there as we were turning on, and he pushed it through the window to the air, because the air gunner had a strip of Perspex removed from his rear turret, so he was virtually in the fresh air, passed it through. The mid-upper gunner went back and fetched it, and we put it up and breathed a sigh of relief. It was as silly as that. But at any rate, back to...
Now what would you do when you... tell me about... I mean, you get into the aircraft, and then what would you do? I mean, what was your position like? Can you describe the position you're in? And I mean,
well, first thing, I had to sit down, and I drew my curtain across that shielded me from the pilot and engineer. I'd check that I'd got all my instruments, lay them out on the chart table. I'd plug my oxygen in, ready for when I wanted it. I'd hang my parachute up on the two hooks behind my position. And then I sat there waiting for the takeoff. We'd all be in our positions.
And what was the takeoff procedure? Which details you can remember?
Well, once the flashing light came from a caravan at the end of the runway where the controller was, he flashed green, and that was our signal to take off. You know, we were at the front of the queue by that time. The pilot would turn on and start pushing the throttles, right through all four throttles. I think helped by the engineer, they got the throttle right forward. And then it was my job to read off the airspeed, because I had duplicate instruments in my place, office I used to call it. I'd got the airspeed indicator and compasses, everything I'd got duplicates of. So I would read there 70, 80, 90, and I think round about 90 to 100 knots, the pilot would gently ease back, and we would stagger, I say stagger, into the air, because of full bomb load and full petrol load to go on this particular flight. And then, of course, I turned and started dead reckoning from the airfield, and I'd start putting in the courses. I'd already worked out the first course to fly to give the pilot on the Met Wind that's being given us, and so we flew that course. And then very often we would get a pinpoint going over the coast, and Dave lying down prone in the bomb bay would give me an exact, he was very good at map reading, an exact pinpoint, and that would give me an exact start, and it would also give me a chance to get some idea of how the winds differed from the Met winds, although we were still climbing at that time. And then I carried on. Every 12 minutes I updated my chart, and so I was working very hard all the time. It took my mind off what we were doing. So we took the winds on the climb and averaged them out, and then applied it to find out what my position was at the top of the climb. Although very often I'd had another fix from Dave as we were crossing the enemy coast.
So that would allow you to start again?
Yes, that would allow me to start again.
Now, what
and also, of course, we got G at this time. So I was working the G like mad all the time, getting these fixes.
But and it would stop working when you went over the German coast?
Yes, very low. If you were lucky, you got about 10 to 20 miles inland before the jamming got so bad you couldn't read your blips from the false blips. But we did have a spare RF unit, which was the radio frequency unit working the G, receiving their frequencies. And when you got near the target, about 5 minutes off, you pulled out this, it had a big handle on, you pulled it out, and you got the spare one, and you pushed it in underneath the G set, and it would change to all the new frequencies that were now being broadcast. And you got about 2 minutes or 3 minutes at the most before the Germans cottoned on to the change in frequencies, monitoring them and then starting jamming. But if you were lucky, you got a good fix right near the enemy target, right near ETA. So then, on that first trip, we had to go, we crossed France and into the Bay of Biscay, and we went right down about 20, 30 miles off the coast.
Can I ask you a question? Were you flying, I mean, was it a big raid? Were there lots of other bombers? And did you fly independently within a bomber stream, as they call it? You weren't in formation.
No, we weren't.
You were flying independently, but you were in a bomber stream.
Yes.
Can you explain how that worked?
Well, we were given an assembly point somewhere just inland of the coast, where the bombers from our 61 and 50 from our airfield and from the other five group, because we often flew as a group, you see, we would try and converge at certain times, we were given certain times, to make this assembly point. And then the pilot and bomb aimer and the engineer had to keep their eyes peeled, because aircraft were joining you from all angles, and then you went on the course that had been set to go out over the coast and out on the raid. So you're flying independently in a stream, and it was hazardous. One of the reasons that you were discouraged from turning back is that turning back was often more dangerous than carrying on, because you were turning right across this bomber stream, which were at different heights, because although they said, say, 1,200 feet, 1,500 feet, there were some above and some below. And on this particular trip, we didn't have, after crossing the enemy coast, where you always got flak coming up, we didn't get any enemy opposition at all. Well, this is always going to be like this. And then I gave the course into the target, across the coast. We got a little bit of flak crossing in.
And what was that like, the first time being under fire?
It was a bit unreal. You heard this bump, bump, bump. And then you could see flashes as the shells exploded. At night time, if you got light flak, that was pretty, because you got tracer bullets mixed up with the ordinary bullets. And they were coloured red, green, blue. And they seemed to spiral lazily in a beautiful spiral. And then all of a sudden they whizzed past as they got near. And once they whizzed past, you know you're all right. But suddenly you heard a pat, pat, pat on the fuselage, and you knew those were ones that hit. You were all right if it was a bullet, but if it was a tracer that hit you, it could start fires and things.
Now, the other danger is night fighters, and it says that your pilot was performing banking searches. Now, I've not heard of that, but can you explain what that was?
Well, night fighters like to come up underneath you in your blind spot. You could see forward, you could see upwards, you could see to the rear and to each side with mid-upper turrets and things, but you couldn't see directly below you. And if they could get unseen in a position below you, they could again suddenly swoop up, tilt upwards, fire into your belly. And of course you'd got all the bombs underneath there, and then they would dive down and away. So the banking search was roll starboard, so you were on one wing up, and then roll over, roll port, and all the time the gunners were scanning beneath them. A bit disconcerting for the navigator again. A good pilot could do this with the maximum of discomfort, and Jack was a good pilot, but he
the
still
minimum of discomfort.
Minimum of discomfort, but you just had to grab onto your pencils and things.
Now, what about the approach to the target? You didn't see any night fighters, I don't think, on this trip.
No, I didn't.
Now, what about the approach to the target? What's the situation? How do you and the bomb aimer and the pilot? Because you're the navigator, the bomb aimer is the chap who's going to pinpoint it, and then the pilot's the poor chap who has to,
Yes.
How is it done?
Well, about 5 minutes before ETA, I give the pilot the last alteration of course to my reckoning to fly over the target. And then the bomb aimer would take over, and he would control the aircraft from that point on. He'd be lying down, telling the pilot, left, left, steady, steady, right, steady, until he got the aiming point on his target indicator. Now, I can't remember whether there were pathfinders at that time. I have a feeling we hadn't got them on that raid. Which is supposed to be a relatively easy raid. But when our time came to go over the target, you got the usual flak over the target. But they said, bombs gone. The bombs wouldn't go. They hung up and tried again. In fact, I think Jack went round again, because he always had two goes at it. And again, they wouldn't release. And so we aborted with heavy hearts. I mean, you felt a failure. This was your first op. And of course, flying back over the sea again, over the Bay of Biscay, we're jinking about and jinking about.
Now, there's a problem. Before you go, there's a problem about the fuses, isn't there?
Yes.
Because you couldn't just land with them.
No.
Can you explain that?
Well, the the bombs were all right, although it was dangerous, because although they were supposed to go off on impact, you know, heavy landing could set them off. So it wasn't wise. But the J-type canisters of incendiaries, they were set to go off at 1,000 feet. So as soon as you flew over and descended to 1,000 feet, your incendiaries would go off and you would go up. So, again, there was a great degree of apprehension. We'd got the bomb doors open, and we're throwing the aircraft about in all sorts of manoeuvres to try and shake the bombs loose. And they did come loose, and they all came down.
All of them?
All of them came.
Do you know what had caused them to hang up?
Well, some fault with the circuits. Electrical circuits, because we didn't get into any trouble about coming back. And the next night we did exactly the same trip.
What happened on the way back then? What would you be? Was it just as dangerous on the way? Were you aware of that? It's just as dangerous on the way back.
We're always aware, because the danger was that night fighters by now would be aware of the raid and be waiting for you. And there was also a tendency for night fighters to follow the in over the coast and get you at a moment of relaxation when the airfield was in sight and you're packing everything up, relaxing. But no, we got back okay and had our eggs and bacon in the mess
now,
after the debriefing.
No, that's what I thought. Now, first, what about handing over the airplane to the ground crew? How was that done? I mean, who would report to them? Presumably, they'd say the bomb release gear doesn't work. But
I think what happened was that we got into the crew bus and were taken to a briefing, and the bombing leader would get the report from the bomb aimer, and he would contact the ground crew and get them to investigate.
Now, what was the debriefing process? What happened at the debriefing? How was it done?
First of all, you got a cup of big mug of tea, and then you sat round as a crew. You took your turns to sit round separate tables with a debriefing officer, often a WAF, and then she'd ask all questions, and you'd look at my log and pilot's log, and ask pertinent questions about what the colour of the flak was and things like that. How many night fighters did you see, and did you see any other aircraft go down? And that was quite a sight to see one go down.
But you hadn't seen any on go down on that trip?
No, not on that trip, no.
And would you have another debriefing with the bomber, you know, with the speciality people, you know, the navigating leader and the rest of it? Or was it just with it?
No, it was just the general debriefing. Often the navigator officer would sit in, but he'd go from crew to crew. But he'd take your log, and he would go right through it and replot it, and then assess you on it. I don't understand this. You've got this course, but when I'm checking it, I only find here, and you know, things like that. So you can't cook your log.
And then what about the crew meal, this eggs and bacon? Was that really important? I mean, people go on about it a lot. Was it important to you?
Well, remember, it was a rationed Britain. Eggs were very scarce. One a week, I think, if you were lucky, in Civvy Street. And bacon, so many ounces a month. So to have a big meal of toast and eggs and bacon, it was quite good. But you were often dead tired by this time, of course. Unbelievably tired.
Now, how did that affect you? I mean, what were the effects of fatigue at that?
Well, there were two. If you'd taken wakey-wakey pills, it hit you twice as hard. In fact, we learned to do without them. They were benzogen tablets or something.
They're an amphetamine.
Yes. That kept you alert on long, long trips.
Now, had you taken them that first trip?
No. No, I don't think I had.
Did you ever take them?
Yes.
And what effect did they have?
Well, it meant that the next day you'd almost got a hangover. You slept so heavily that we learned it was better to try and keep awake by other means rather than take them.
Did they keep you awake, though?
They kept you awake.
They worked?
Yeah, they worked, oh yes. Kept you awake. But mind you, it wasn't such a problem with me because every 12 minutes I was plotting and replotting courses and things and working out and giving courses. So while you're doing that, you're not going to sleep. And I think if pilot didn't get his alteration every 12 minutes or course confirmation, he'd say, John, where are you?
Now, the other thing about that raid was you'd bombed the wrong time. You hadn't.
No.
But only because you'd missed, the bombs hadn't worked. But the raid generally had missed the target, hadn't it?
That's right, yes. It turned out it had been a camp of displaced people or something. I think they corrected that for the next night. And the next night we went.
That'd be the 29th?
Yes. Did the same trip all over again, and this time everything worked like a dream, and we bombed successfully and got an aiming point photograph.
So, and that was an uneventful Right. Now, the next, from now on, we don't look at raids in quite so much detail, obviously, because that would be...
But tedious,
we're looking at, well, not tedious perhaps, but it's just almost impossible for you to remember. What we're now looking at is some ones you've picked out in your memoirs.
Yes.
The first of these is 1st of May, when you target Toulouse.
Toulouse, which was a very long flight, and that was where I saw an aircraft hit just in front of us, and it was a graphic. I can still see it etched really clearly. See the people inside scrambling to get their parachutes and get them on, and scrambling to get to the escape hatch because the whole interior was lit up. The whole of the cockpit was lit up, and then it just turned over and went down. But of course, at that time we were way past it, so we never saw if any parachutes came out.
Did that affect you? I mean, obviously it affected me. I mean, was it, how bad was it, and or did you just were you able to put it out of your mind at the time? But, you know,
at the time, you were more concentrating on getting your own aircraft to where it should be. But the trip I really picked out was the 3rd of May, and that was to Mailly-le-Camp.
So that's another camp. It's a Panzer, a German tank supply depot.
Yes, Mailly-en-camp. And it's quite near the Ruhr. It wasn't too far from the Ruhr. And I think something went wrong with communications on that raid, because the pathfinders arrived a bit late, I think, because the winds were opposite to what Met had said. We got there pretty well on time. We were waiting for the signal to drop the bombs. And the master bomber had given the command to bomb, but because something had gone wrong with the frequencies, only a few aircraft heard the signal to bomb. They went in and bombed, and there was relatively light opposition, and went home. I wondered what all the fuss was about. We were orbiting, waiting for the signal to bomb, which we didn't hear. And this gave time for the fighters from the Ruhr to arrive. And so it ended up with practically Lancaster fighter going round in circles, firing at each other. And
what do you remember of that? I mean, you wouldn't be able to see much of this, I presume.
No, I didn't see much of anything, because as soon as I pulled my curtain back and tried to stand up between Jack and Norman, Jack would get agitated and say, go back, John, sit down. He didn't want to lose his navigator, have to find his own way home. But I learnt much of what went on the raids from the chatter on the intercom, although Jack tried to suppress that as much as possible.
Now tell me about what sort of chatter would you get on the intercom?
Well, you would get something like, well, first of all, aircraft on the port, 1100 or something like that, 11 o'clock, and mid up a gun, I see it. The bomb aimer would say about things he saw, and as long as it was relevant, Jack didn't mind. As soon as he started, I mean, at one time, over Germany, Paddy put radio on, and it was Carol Gibbons and his Savoy Orpheans, and there we were at midnight, and he said, and this is Carol Gibbons from the Savoy Theatre, I think, or Savoy Hotel, and we then got dance music, and Jack, pull that off. But it was funny to think they were all dancing back in London and we were over Germany. Anyway, on this